In the gigantic conceptions of Einstein, the velocity of light, 186,300 miles per second, dominates the whole theory of relativity. He proved mathematically that the velocity of light is, as far as man's finite mind is concerned, the only constant in a universe of unstable flux. On the sole absolute of light velocity depends all human standards of time and space. Well, that's interesting, you see, because time and space is something that is variable, and what we know of time and space is the product of our own consciousness. That's being realized more and more, and it's been taught for years and taught for centuries by the seers and the philosophers. On the sole absolute of the light velocity depend all human standards of time and space. Not abstractly eternal as hitherto considered, time and space are relative and finite factors, deriving their measurement validity only in the reference to the yardstick of light velocity. Remember yesterday we suggested that light velocity had that speed within the compass of the Earth's atmosphere, and that it was possible that the speed of light increased considerably, increased tremendously, outside the atmosphere of the Earth and interplanetary space. And that would then do away with the tremendous number of light years that light takes to reach us from some stars. It seems to be very probable that that is the case. But Einstein was measuring it from the point of view of a scientist on this Earth. In joining space as a dimensional relativity, time has surrendered its despotic claims to unconditional values. Time is now stripped of its rightful nature, a simple essence of ambiguity. And a few equational strokes of his pen, Einstein has banished from the cosmos every fixed reality except that of light. Because remember, we said yesterday that matter and energy are interchangeable. And matter, by multiplying it by the constant of the square of the constant, which is the speed of light, becomes energy. And when matter disappears altogether, we get ultimate energy, which is, of course, not matter at all, but the last essential constant, which is ultimate energy, or energy with ultimate velocity. Now, light, therefore, appears to the seer and the clairvoyant as that which wells up from higher dimensions and which is the energy side of the manifestation of the Logos. And of course you've got that right in the beginning when the phrase, the biblical phrase was, "Let there be light," and there was light. And that was the first manifestation of the universe. In a later development, his unified field theory, the great physicist embodied in one mathematical formula the laws of gravitation and of electromagnetism. Reducing the cosmical structure to variations on a single law, Einstein reached across the ages to the rishis who proclaimed a single texture of creation, that of a protean maya, maya or illusion, the illusion of matter. That's all there is. Remember, we talked about that yesterday. The first basic difference is matter and energy. And matter and energy are interchangeable, and they are maya. And through them plays life. Life and form, because life is always associated with form. The two go together. That's an idea we're inclined to forget. We're inclined to say, well, I said it yesterday, I think that the spirit of man is the important thing, and he has bodies, and he has a personality. But we have to consider the two together, because life must, of a necessity, create form. Or in other words, there can only be life when there is form. So although the form is transient and unreal, in a sense, then it is also necessary for the manifestation of life. You see, you can't do one without the other. Now, we'll get to something easier in a moment. This is I'd like to read a little bit now from this book by Mrs. Josephine Ransom, where she talks about the types of the universe, matter of the universe, because again, this will go over a little bit of what we said. There are only 7 types of matter in our universe, say the old investigators. Those are sufficient for our scheme, apparently, and for the moment. Another scheme may have 10 or a dozen or more. The suggestion is that God uses for the purpose of his universe the 2 immensities of spirit and matter, as all gods must learn them, there being nothing else. He gives to their essentialness within the ring pass not, a delightful phrase, called also the rope of the angels. That's the encompassing envelope or skin, which is, of course, a principle throughout the hold of the universe, just as our skin is the periphery for the physical body and contains the physical body, so every unit in the manifested universe has its skin, and the skin is important because it's on the outside of the skin that you contact that which is outside. So nearly all the senses of the physical body are on the skin. In fact, they all are. And it's exactly the same when you consider the astral and the mental bodies. There is an impingement on the outside of that skin against that which is outside. And so the skin is very important. That's the ring pass knot. The ring pass knot of the physical earth is where the atmosphere disintegrates and we get tremendous rarefaction. Not so definite there. But the top 9 inches of the soil of the earth, the physical ring pass knot, is very important too, because that's where the whole of mankind, you get sidetracked, the whole of mankind is sustained by the top 9 inches of the soil of the earth. Now you can argue as much as you like, it goes down in some cases to 2 feet or 3 feet, but that is a fact. That's where vegetation grows, and that's where the bacterial life takes place. And that is again, you see, the importance of a ring pass knot, in that case the physical ring pass knot of the earth. And the whole of the solar system has its own ring pass knot outside it. Each of the 7 types of matter within his area is specialized by him for the life he wishes to express, assisted by his agents, who are his co-workers in many fields, as well as by a countless host of creatures ready to swarm out of latency through the vast reaches of the various parts of God, and each and all seeing life fully. Also, one mysterious suggestion remains, that the only new thing in the universe is a fresh set of permutations of spirit and matter that mark the 7 great types of matter. In them we see the setting in motion of a new wave of consciousness destined for self-consciousness in some other universe, and we are never to forget that this matter is now a universal type. Now, it is very necessary for the purpose of some forms of yoga to understand that each direct energy of God plays inexhaustibly within each type of atom, and that atoms are primal energies at the level of that condition called ultimate. And if a physical atom could be realized, one of God's blazing energies could be contacted. It would lead, as it were, direct to him in that phase of himself and be found to be a cosmic and terrific force. There are, therefore, 7 such types of atoms or forces, and all are but encasements of one breath, the one breath which blows in all directions and is life. Now I'm going to stop reading and try and explain something that isn't easy and it isn't clearly put entirely. That is the nature of the manifestation of God's forces in the universe. Now we talked about the creation of the universe, the ring pass knot, and then the creation by creative sound, or the word. And the first activity was the creation by Fohat, which was the primary action of the third logos and the first outpouring, which created the atomic structure and held back the primordial darkness by the will of the Logos, but by the force of Fohat. So we get that as the first outpouring, the first activity in the creation of the universe. And then you get the second, which is the peopling of the field, which is done by creating sparks of consciousness within that, which are sparks of the divine, which I'll come to in a moment, and then creating life and form. Now it is said that the power or force of the Logos, which corresponds to this second activity or second outpouring, is that of prana. Now you all know that prana comes from the sun. It is the energizing force that sustains the universe by coming and direct radiations from the sun. But when you come to the chakras, a book by C.W. Leadbeater, you find that there is there explained what happens in the case of man. Now, that book was written later than the Etheric Double, which Powell wrote, and contains some very good work in it, some extremely important ideas. But they're not just quite clearly put. I don't suppose you could get any book that's perfect. And there is a little question mark in my mind as to what he exactly means. Because he says, at the solar plexus of each man, at our stage of evolution anyway, two mighty forces meet. Now, one comes up from the earth and is of the nature of Kundalini. But I don't think it is actually Kundalini until it is passed through a center of consciousness, which is a being. I'm not quite sure about that, but it's generally considered to be Kundalini when it flows up the spine. But those two forces meet here in this chakra, and they form a mighty vortex. They sort of grind. He uses the word grind on one another like that. It's a sort of a double vortex going like that. And as they grind on one another, the force coming from above, which he calls the primary force. Now, it's probable that both these are different polarities of Fohat. I'm not quite sure about that. I don't quite know what he means by primary force. But most certainly, he is absolutely definite in the fact that these two, meeting at the solar plexus, grind on one another. The whirls, you see, because chakras are whirls, they're vortexes. In this case, you've got two forces whirling in against one another, forming a friction and combining or resulting in a new flow which goes right up the spine and vivifies the whole of the nervous system of the body. If you've seen the chakras, you'll see the diagrams of how that flows and the various colors which it takes. Now, as soon as that grinding takes place, there seems to be created a nervous field which can take in the prana. Now, prana are vitality, which you get in vitality globules and in food and in suggested in certain types of bacteria. That comes and is the result of the energies thrown off from the sun, but it doesn't seem to be able to be absorbed until you have that grinding, that intermingling of the two major forces. So in the universe, then, we have these aspects of God that we know about. We have Fohat, which is the energies. Do you remember the chart I showed you yesterday of all these energies? Wave motion. It's safe to say that all those are aspects of Fohat. All those are aspects of Fohat, all wave energy. And time again, it's been said, and Mr. Hodgson has often said it, that electricity is the direct sign or indication of the manifestation of God in the universe. In other words, electricity is the direct power of the Creator. But if that's the case, all these being of the same nature but different wavelengths are also manifestations of the divine energy, and they are all Fohat. But besides that, we've got prana, which comes from the sun, and we've got this mysterious force of Kundalini, which she calls the force that does two things. First of all, it's coiled up like a serpent and is released as evolution takes place, and it's burning and it clears away everything. It's just irresistible once it flows. But it's tied up with the consciousness of man. It is linked definitely with man. But there is a force which comes from the center of the earth, where the great laboratory of the earth exists, where the new forms of atoms elements are, as it were, created. There's a mystery there, and I think they're not very well able to explain to you. But we have those forces. We have the prana, which is the second aspect, which is the life-giving. And we have Fohat, which is life-giving as far as matter and energy are concerned. And then we have Kundalini, which is the force that flows in the units of consciousness of which man is one.
Where would you place magnetism?
Magnetism is here. Magnetism is an aspect of Fohat. I think that would be quite right. Would you like to have anything to say about the primary force from above? You haven't met that term.
Yes, I have, but I don't think you could put it more clearly than you have done.
No. I wondered about Christ consciousness, but Christ consciousness or Buddhic consciousness is an individual thing, and it comes through the head chakra, and it is something that we experience as we evolve. It's a knowledge of the whole by the individual. It's an expansion, and it isn't a force, an impersonal force of God in the sense that the others are. But it is for the individual the knowledge of the sustaining power of God in the second aspect, the love aspect. But in his first principles, Mr. Jinnarajitasa states that prana is the, on the physical plane, the expression of the force of the second logos is prana or vitality. Now, evidently that, you see, is the physical aspect of it, and it's prana which sustains all life, and is probably of the same nature as that at the higher level that we call the impersonal sustaining love or charity of God. Now,
in what relation would the sun be to that force of prana?
Well, there is not the slightest doubt that the pranic forces come from the sun. Where sunshine and where prana is lacking. That's why, of course, in dull days there's less vitality globules in the world, and when sunshine is present, vitality is higher. That is well established. And it's probably Fohat that wells up from a higher dimension. Although at the same time, we don't know exactly to what extent prana can slip from one dimension or one world to another. It probably does exactly the same thing. Now, I don't think that we should go into the question of any more of the creation of the universe, but we'll try and go straight into the subject that I wanted to go into especially tonight, which is the the monad, and the nature of man, because the monad is the first focus as far as man's consciousness is concerned. Now, the monad is linked with the creation of the universe, because the monads were formed at the creation of the universe. And the source of all being is an absolute, a God unmanifest, the unknowable. And there are periods of quiescence and activity, of rest and activity, the cyclic motion of rest and activity, as far as the Creator is concerned, just as there is as far as man is concerned. And the primordial night, and the Spirit of God moved on the face of the waters and said, "Let there be light." And then we have the first differentiation of spirit and matter, which forms the web of the universe, the focal points of which are where the lines intersect, and we there get a point of God's consciousness focused and appearing to the clairvoyant as light. Born of the relationship of the two is Fohat, or the energy that sustains the whole of the universe. And our solar system is a better word, of course, because we won't go outside the solar system for purposes of this study. Fohat scatters the atoms, digs holes in space, and then we get the primordial seven, and they control. I spoke about that yesterday when we were talking about the gunas, that we have the seven mighty spirits around the throne of God, put many different ways in the Bible, but they are the seven heads of the seven different rays, and they are the seven aspects of matter and the seven primary energies. And the atoms are formed in seven different basic ways according to the nature of these primordial seven. And they circumscribe the field karmically, from the point of view of karma or action, and they put the ring past knot round the solar system. And in that ring past knot, the seven planes are formed, with Fohat the binding unity, Fohat being the energizing force of the Logos. Now, the original atoms within the solar ring past knot are virgin in the sense that they come from outside the solar system, from the cosmic plane, to want of a better term, or they come from the universe as a whole. Now that's important, because that means that at the creation of the universe, there is a link between our solar system and all other manifestations, whether they're solar systems or galaxies or what have you. The whole of the universe as we know it, all the stars, are linked. Now, the spark hangs from the flame by the finest thread of Fohat, and that is the monad. Now, that's the definition given in the secret doctrine. But what you want to realize is that it's an Adi atom. Now, an Adi is the seventh plane. Perhaps I should have put those up earlier. You know, you all know your planes fairly well, I should think. You've got your physical here, your astral, your mental, buddhic, atmic, will. Then you've got the an, anapadika, and adi is up here. Now that would do, I think, for the time being, for the purposes of this discussion. We've got the seven there. This is the center, and that is the center for man. Perhaps we'll talk about that later. But the Adi atom, right up here, which belongs to the God the unknowable, God the absolute, is pre-solar. It comes from the universe, because the solar system has not at that stage been created. And it's vivified by a spark from the solar lord the Creator, and in this case the Son, because the Son comes first. A breath of the solar Lord flows through that particular Adi atom, and it is vivified, and it is always linked by that thread of force, of Fohat, to the Godhead. Now, to each spark is attached 5 of the original atoms to link it with each of the 5 lower planes. The monad permanently retains these 5 atoms. Now, this is the basis, of course, of all the teaching in the secret doctrine. You have here a pre-solar atom that's cosmic in its nature, and it is linked down here to, it is vivified and lowered to the Anipadaka plane, which is the next one down. Then attached to it are 5 more atoms. One there, which belongs to the Atmic, which is will. One there belongs to the Buddhic, which is intuition or unity. One here which belongs to the mental world. One here belonging to the astral world. And one belonging to the physical world. And those are the permanent atoms. And you've often heard what talk about the permanent atoms. You find it all the way through the study in consciousness by Mrs. Besant. And they are something that, unless you get your primary definition of what they actually are, you'll find it very difficult to find their significance. Now, the first important point is that they are cosmic in their nature. Now, each of these vivified cosmic atoms at that level becomes a monad. That is a focus of the life of God in the new solar system. Just a focus, latent, but developing to potential, and potential perfection, which I'll show you how it does later. Well, then attached to it by this string of light are the 5 permanent atoms. Now, these permanent atoms are cosmic in their nature. They exist at the 7th subplane of each plane. And in fact, the matter of the first, I should call it the first subplane, the highest subplane. The matter of the highest subplane is called atomic, and it is of the nature of the whole solar system. And that's as important too, because there are methods of consciousness through those atoms, what we call the ultimate physical, ultimate astral, ultimate mental atom. There is a path of consciousness up those which is direct, and which gets away from the illusion of Maya. Because you see, when you got the illusion of Maya, you have it on the lower subplanes of each plane, and to a certain extent, the first subplane is free of that illusion. Well, that is a withdrawal of the personality from the world of Maya, and a dwelling in the first subplane of each plane, which is ultimate and cosmic in its nature, and allows the consciousness to be one with God in a direct manner. And that, of course, is, I think, what Mr. Krishnamurti is suggesting as a possibility, and it is a possibility.
That is cosmic consciousness,
quite definitely. And the place that we first meet it is at the Buddhic level, but it also exists at these. This would be Nirvanic consciousness. That's Buddhic consciousness. This would be Nirvanic, and so on. But that is cosmic consciousness. There are cosmic planes. The first subplane of each plane is a cosmic plane, because its atoms come from the outside of the cosmic or universe after creation. And we each have one of those atoms in ourselves, and therefore we have the potential link, not only with the solar system, but with the whole of the cosmos, because we contain, tied to us, each of those, at each level of existence, one of those permanent atoms. Now, it's very interesting, because It's said quite definitely that conception of the human being cannot take place until those permanent atoms are present. And the permanent atom is not there until all the karmic forces are adjusted and the time is right for the person to be conceived and born. Now that's a startling thought, but it's true, you see. And that's why it's true. It's because creation at any level is something to do not only with the solar logos, but with the whole of cosmos. And that is our link. And when I was going into this on Monday, but that is the case way down here. It's also the case in the mental and the astral level that these permanent atoms must be there before anything, before creation at that level can take place. Now, once this is vivified, it sounds out its own individual note. That is, the monad of all, of each particular monad, has its own individual note, completely individual and completely necessary for the creation of the whole. The development of God to his latent perfection depends entirely on the development to perfection of each individual monad. And there you have your basis of brotherhood. It's just as simple as that. And they are individually different. You remember when I showed you these gunas, how it was possible mathematically to get the variations that mean there's just a slight element of difference in each? Well, that is the case with the monads. They're just slightly different. So each individual has his work to do. And he alone can do it. Therefore, there should be no competition. Competition belongs to the world of the animals. It doesn't belong to man. There ought to be cooperation because we know that each person has his work to do and he's got to find that. Now, that is what has been called his dharma. His duty, his karmic responsibility. It's more than that, it's his individual note. And it's said, you know, yesterday I said that the word Om was the keynote of the fifth root race. Well, also each of us have a keynote in creative sound, which is the note of that monad. Then, having got these permanent atoms, they are vivified as required by the individual. Now, the vivification of those is I better wait till I get the next diagram. But the permanent atom of each one of us is, I think, often better thought of as a pattern atom. All that is permanent in us belongs to that permanent atom. It contains the results of all our past actions right from the very beginning. It contains our individual note, and it contains all our thoughts and feelings and the pattern of our physical appearance, the pattern of our astral appearance, the pattern of our mental appearance, and the pattern of our future archetype. Now, all that is contained in the permanent atom. It's there right in the beginning, latent, but it's to be developed. And it cannot be developed in any way except according to the original pattern. Therefore, the evolution for us is absolutely definite. We may tarry, we may make mistakes, we may be delayed, but we must ultimately reach that perfection that was there in an archetypal form right in the very beginning. Is that clear? And then you see, it's right to say that for each one of us, their perfect justice rules the world, and each son will one day reach his feet. That is true, because that link is in each one of us. The monad and his anchors, I often think of them as anchors on the lower planes. Those vivified atoms, the permanent atoms on the lower planes, are the anchors in matter. Now, if you look at this diagram, which is the descent into matter, if you take that, I haven't mentioned the ego yet. The ego is the monad manifesting on those three planes. He can't manifest on this plane. There's no duality at the anapadika plane. And until there is duality, you can't get life. I explained that yesterday. You have to have the interaction between consciousness, or spirit, and matter, energy, before you get life. You have to have that friction, that resistance, before you can get life. So there's no life here. The monad is perfect. It is one with God, a spark that hangs by a thread of Fohat from God, and it cannot change. But it uses an instrument, and the first instrument it creates is the ego, or the higher self. And that dwells on the atmic level, the level of will, and the Buddhic level, the level of intuition or unity, and touches the upper part of the mental world, which is the abstract mental world above the fourth subplane. And that becomes the higher self of each. Now, the higher self is much more important than anything we know in the personality or the physical. So on this diagram, it's shown as the whole of that mass of red. It is a blinding glory, the Ogoides, it was called, and Mr. Hodson often uses that term. And it is the spiritual self of each one of us, again, latent.
Isn't the resurrection body?
Pardon?
The resurrection body.
The resurrection body, you might recognize it by that term as well, yes. It's the seat of Christ consciousness too, but that's only one aspect of it. Anyway, the point I wanted to make was that when it comes down here into the physical world at birth, it has to have an anchor. And the anchor it has is the permanent atom. And it pulls itself down into matter by that permanent atom, which is, we remember the study class, we had a great argument about this, as to whether the permanent atom exists in the physical world, in the astral world, or whether it exists entirely in the Buddhic world. Well, there is no doubt about it that it is stored in the causal body, in the Buddhic world, which is the world of the ego, but it must have the same quality as the matter of which it will be the pattern in the future. And the astral permanent atom must therefore have the same quality as astral matter, even if it is stored in the Buddhic. It doesn't, time and space don't matter. It's the quality of its vibration to be done. Now, I think that almost covers the question of the monad. Perhaps we could leave and go further into the question of the ego on Monday. Perhaps we've had enough for today. Is there any question anybody would like to ask?
I was just wondering, Mr. Patterson, about this permanent atom in the physical body. I think Mrs. Besson says somewhere that it is a kind of essence instead of being anything more tangible than that.
That's right, yes. It certainly is an atom in the usual term. And it certainly is an essence in that it contains the essential pattern of all the future and all the past, as well as the present of each one of us. In that case, it's most definitely an essence. Oh, I know what I wanted to show you. Yes, the permanent atom is a bad word. I don't know what to call it. There isn't really a very good word. But perhaps today we ought to take this, because this is tied up with the whole thing. Here you have the spirit or the ego, which is the instrument used in the first case for the monad to manifest in matter and to gain experience from matter. Now, when we start, we go down into matter in the involving arc, the descent into matter. And now, the monad, through that descent into matter, literally sleeps. It is there, but it has very little consciousness. In fact, it's not developing its consciousness during that descent, but it's losing it. Now, the elemental life of the body is concerned, you all know that the automatic, there's a body elemental which looks after the automatic life of the body, the breathing and that sort of thing. Well, that life is identifying itself with matter through sensation, and it loves repetition, it loves stability, and it loves especially rhythmic action, habitual action, and it loves strong action, violent sensation. You'll see all that in your own body, in your own elemental, which is this type of force, which is pulling itself down into matter by identifying itself with matter. So we come down to what's sometimes called the monadic essence and are pulled down into matter until there is the very beginnings of awakening in the monad at the mineral level. The faint trillings of consciousness awaken at that level. And the monad, of course, the spark in the mineral, encompasses a tremendous amount of quantity, as we would know it, of one particular type of mineral. A tremendous amount. But as we go up through the vegetable and animal kingdoms, the amount or the number of trees or the number of animals that come under one monad is decreased as the awareness of the monad gradually increases. So the monad sleeps in the mineral, wakes in the vegetable, begins to consciousness in the animal, not self-consciousness, but consciousness, and in the human wakes to self-consciousness. The group soul then becomes smaller and smaller in the number of entities attached to it, because you know an animal doesn't have its own self-consciousness. It has an instinctual consciousness, and that's the key to instinct, you see. It has an instinctual consciousness which belongs to the monad in charge of its particular group. That's why each migrating bird knows exactly where to go, because it's part of the consciousness of birds which have done that for centuries and centuries and centuries. You see the idea? It's linked with that. Well, now, when you get to this stage here, in the human being, something new happens, and it's called the third outpouring. And at that stage, the monad becomes self-conscious. Well, the monad doesn't, but the ego, which is the instrument of the monad, the higher self, becomes self-consciousness and aware in its own right. It no longer is a group soul. It's one person only, incarnating from then on. And the permanent atom at the mental world is the one, of course, that is important at that stage, because it is the one that takes the expansion. Oh, I think probably it takes place the Buddhic too. I'd have to read up studying consciousness. It's very well explained there. But the permanent atoms get a new quality at that stage, because then, from then on, we are self-conscious. And from then on, evolution is a matter of getting back consciously to the source of all being from which we have come. And we then have a link again with the monad through the ego. Now, in all this time, the link was lost. And that losing of the link has been perpetuated. That story has been perpetuated for us in mythology in dozens and dozens of fairy stories. Every time I hear Hansel and Gretel, my little daughter's got a record of it, I can't help thinking about that, and Cinderella is another one. Especially Hansel and Gretel, it's very, very interesting. The babes go out in the woods and are lost, and they drop crumbs to try and keep the knowledge of this in which they lose contact with the higher, with God. And you remember, the birds eat up the crumbs, and then they find the witch in the sugar plum castle or something, and they start to eat the sweets of that house in which she lives. The sweets are, of course, identification with Maya, identification with the lower bodies. And as they eat those, life is very good and they are very happy and enjoy themselves. And then she comes back and tries to imprison them completely. That means that they're going to be shut off permanently from their knowledge of their divinehood. And of course, they get her tangled up in the brambles, don't they? And they run away again. And then there appears a little white dove. Now the white dove, of course, has always been the symbol of the soul, the spirit, the ego, the higher self. And that dove leads them back to their own home, and the mother takes them back in, and everything is all right. Well, the dove appears, the white dove appears at that point. It's in all mythology, the northern mythology as well. Search for the Holy Grail is the same thing, because at this point the possibility of Christ consciousness, which is the redeeming factor in the world, reappears again. It didn't exist, it was lost during that time. And the dove comes back, and from that point onward leads them back home. And that's evolution. How you would interpret it as a case of Cinderella is just possibly a little bit different, but the same thing applies. It's the fitting of the shoe, you see, that is the key. Then the link between the higher and the lower takes place at that point, and that's when she puts on the shoe again, and she realizes that she's one with the higher self, which is, of course, the prince. You see the... and the marriage is there, and they take place again. But the reason why those old fairy stories, I didn't mean to talk about fairy stories at all anymore. The reason why they have been perpetuated is that they were taught by the jesters of the medieval courts. Now, most of those jesters and traveling bards, what were they called?
Troubadours,
were initiated into the mystery schools of those days. And that was their interpretation of the mystery teaching. It was the only interpretation in the Western world during those times.
They had no books, you see.
And they've stayed with us as fairy stories, which is immensely interesting when you come to think of it. And that's not only in Europe, it's throughout Europe, but you'll find exactly the same thing in the Maori stories, you'll find it in Greek mythology, you'll find it in the Red Indian stories, and you'll find it in Indian mythology and Chinese mythology, and I don't know about African, they're a little different, but some of their, I don't know, I think you would find similar things. It's fascinating when you look at them, and also logical, because you see that this whole thing, if you can look at it, you've got to survey the whole picture, and then you find it narrowing down into something that's more simple all the time. Now, is there any question anybody would like to ask about that? Yes?
I'm taken by the monad on the evolution of Germany. Is that comparable at all to the time taken on the evolution of Germany back, or is it quicker?
Well, I don't know.
No, I
would think they're approximately the same, but I don't really know.
From what I've heard C.W. or at least read what he says, it's very much quicker in the last quarter of the journey back to God, because the momentum, it's like a snowball,
yes,
gathering momentum down the mountainside, it gets quicker and quicker.
Yes.
And also the time consciousness is less.
Is less, yes.
Toward the end of the journey. There's no time consciousness practically at the beginning and on the evolutionary journey, which is an immensely slow process, extraordinarily slow process.
Well, I would think that was right. You see, it's been told us by Krishnamurti and many, many others that once you reach this point, the possibility of direct knowledge of the unity of all exists. And once that possibility exists, the time in which you take as an individual in realizing it is entirely up to you. And the time can be very, very short indeed if sufficient effort is made. And that's a necessity for effort. That's what we'll talk about next time, the laws that govern the life from that point up. One of them, of course, is which is the law of karma. The law of karma only exists really from self-consciousness onward. It does exist down here, but it's a little different because you're not self-conscious. It applies only to the group, not to the individual. So there's no doubt about it. What Mr. Banks says is absolutely right, that from there on, the process is speeded up, and the degree to which it can be speeded up is limitless. Because inherently in each one of us is that divine link, not only with the solar logos, but with the whole of the cosmos. That is our cosmic link, and it's there all the time. And once the permanent atoms are revivified at that point and become our own completely, and we have self-consciousness or individuality, then the possibility of speeding up development or evolution is immense. Any other questions? So I don't know exactly, but I would think that it does speed up towards the end and take longer than the first
part. Really, I suppose, would you say, is the whole purpose of the path of holiness?
Yes.
Treading the path of holiness.
It's to speed that process
speed
up.
That process up.
Effort is required, and effort in the spiritual realm is the strongest and most important. You see, there again is a principle that's sometimes forgotten. Our thoughts are more powerful than our feelings, and our feelings are more powerful than physical action. And that which helps us in our evolution is mostly that which we do in our thoughts, and especially in our abstract thoughts, and more especially in meditation, where we touch the Buddhic level, because that is the thing that will affect the whole of the rest of us, the personality and the physical body. Remember that the scientists are now finding that matter and energy are appearing more in the nature of a divine mind. A precipitation downwards of the divine mind into the lower realms. Well, that's exactly the same with us. We are a precipitation downwards of a reality. And the important thing is the reality. In the case of man, it's at the egoic level and centered on the Buddhic world. And it touches the personality at the fourth subplane of the physical, of the mental. But by precipitating down, or bringing down, or challenging, and by our effort and growth and meditation and attempting to live a spiritual life, we challenge that pattern, the spiritual pattern, and we force it to come down. And then, you see, it pushes out all the past. Because the permanent atoms have in them, I should have mentioned this, have in them the memory of the whole of existence in the animal and vegetable kingdoms. That's our lower nature. That comes, we take that with us. So we've got to bring down, once we reach this level, we have the power to bring down the pattern of the spiritual life from a higher level, direct from the Godhead, and, as it were, nullify, that's the word I want.
Cancel out
the whole of the effect of the memory of competitive action and cruelty and all the rest of it that goes with the animal kingdom. We leave out the lower natures. We force the lower nature out by vivifying the good and the higher nature. And that is done by challenging by effort and bringing down the spiritual self.
Is it along those lines that we delete our
bad karma? Yes, well, I was going to keep karma for next time, but that is quite right. Yes, that is quite right. That is how we do it. I've got to keep something for Monday. We bring that up. Yes.
This self-awareness or awakening to self-consciousness is purely an individual matter. There's nothing to do with that awakening to self-consciousness
yes.
of who we are, really.
Yes.
It's purely an individual matter.
Smith.
Yes.
It has nothing to do with the nations or races.
No, it's an individual matter. In the Lives of Alcyone, it gives the story of how Mrs. Besant and Mr. Leadbeater attained their individuality as domestic animals. And they saved the lives of their masters on the moon, their owners. Because we're one chain ahead, that was a moon chain. And that is why our domestic pets become so attached to us. And if we look after them properly, we help them pass that point. A domestic pet close in touch with humans and showing human attributes of love and loyalty and that sort of thing is nearing that point. And there might only be two or three cats in a group soul. They mightn't even be in incarnation at one time. But they are not individuals, so they fade together and one incarnates. And at a certain stage becomes the one expression of the life of that monad. Then it enters the human world. Not automatically, straight away. I wouldn't like even to say that. It is possible, I think, that certain animals are in incarnation already individualized. That might be possible.
Wouldn't a great number be in pralaya?
Yes.
The state of waiting. Suspended consciousness.
Yes, suspended consciousness, waiting correct conditions,
yes,
to come back as humans with others. Their nations might come into it. They would come back with others, you see, at a similar stage of evolution as themselves. And there are stages where they are held back.